You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, May 22nd, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, yo, Dali.
Hey, darling. How you doing?
That is saying hey there in Gungan, of course.
Gungan?
Star Wars Episode 1.
Gungadin?
It sounds like Bill Murray in Caddyshack when he says, a gungula gunga.
It's close, because it's Jar Jar Binks.
Really? Jar Jar Binks?
Well, according to Wikipedia, yeah. And that is a fine resource.
Did you all have a fine vacation yesterday?
What vacation?
Memorial Day.
Memorial Day holiday.
I've had 10 hamburgers since Friday. 10 hamburgers.
Since Friday?
You can only eat a few more this week, I tell you.
That's probably not healthy.
No.
It's been one big picnic. I mean, I don't feel good about myself, but I love those hamburgers though, man.
So yesterday, I got my first picture of a bald eagle.
Oh.
Yeah, it's very cool. There's a bald eagle nesting in Hamden. Evan and I took the families down there to see the nest.
Mm-hmm.
You could see it's like right next to the street, you know, right next to the road.
Yeah.
And, the nest is huge. But we couldn't see anything in the nest. We were hanging out there for about 20 minutes or so, hoping we know from reports that there is a baby in the nest, a baby eagle. But we did see one, possibly both of the parents flying around.
Mm-hmm.
After about 20 minutes, one of the parents showed up and had to fight off an osprey, which was getting too close to the nest. It sort of chased it away, and then it perched next to the nest and just stood there, like, on guard.
Isn't an osprey like one of those, like a crane or something?
No, osprey is like a large seabird that eats fish. And so they both sort of, this is next to a marshy area. So that they have, both bald eagles and ospreys would be in the same sort of niche there.
How big was the eagle, Steve?
It's a huge bird.
Like, if you were standing up and it was standing next to you on the ground, how high up would it come on you?
Oh, I'm not sure, maybe 3 feet.
Oh, wow.
And it's a raptor, correct?
It's a raptor.
Oh, yeah. They don't get much more raptor than an eagle.
They're beautiful, beautiful birds.
Oh, yes.
I saw a bald eagle in Alaska that had lost its beak and they made it a new beak. So it had
cool.
Like a fake beak on it. It was pretty awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, I read about that too.
It was sad because it was still in a cage, but it was cool that they had helped it like that.
Wow. It's like the Tycho Brahe of birds.
Yeah. While in Alaska, I also saw an eagle like swoop down and grab a fish out of the water and then take it away.
Did it go gyar when it swooped down?
B-R?
Gyar. Don't birds make that noise when they swoop down at you? They come down and bite your horsey?
That sound that you hear, Jay, that every movie and TV show plays as the sound of a raptor.
Yeah.
Is a red-tailed hawk. But
yeah,
that's not the sound that eagles make.
That, you mean this sound?
Yeah, that is a red-tailed hawk.
Steve, can you make the sound of an eagle for us right now?
Yeah, let's do it, Steve.
Hey, guess what happened on this day in history? Speaking of none of that, on June 1st, 1965, Arno Penzias and Robert Woodrow Wilson, good name, discovered the background radiation that was a huge part of the proof for the Big Bang.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing radio astronomy using a very sensitive antenna, and they kept getting this interference and they couldn't figure out what it was. It seemed to be coming from everywhere. They were located in New Jersey, so they thought maybe it was coming from New York, but it wasn't because it was like all around. They examined the antenna and they found that it was absolutely covered in pigeon droppings. So they cleaned it off and they murdered the pigeons and they still heard this sound. And so they wrote it up. It turns out, discovered this amazing proof for cosmic microwave background radiation. Well, I think Stephen Hawking called it the final nail in the coffin for the competing steady state theory.
Mm-hmm.
So this one pretty much nailed it for the Big Bang.
And they got the Nobel Prize for Physics for that discovery in 1978.
Wow. They did.
They weren't even initially looking for it.
There were other people who were looking for it, and it was first, you know, it had already been theorized, and so there were people that were looking for it. One of the first people to come up with the idea of it was Ralph Alpher, which is like one of my favorite scientist names of all time because it sounds like Scooby-Doo saying the name of the leader of our gang. Ralph Alpher.
It's true.
So yeah, people have been looking for it. And
so how could you look for it and not find it because it's always there?
Well, they were hot on its trail. So, like Alpher had come up with this idea and also
like missing the ground, right?
Like people weren't very interested in it, apparently. Astronomers just weren't that into it. Like it was a small group of people that were really fascinated by this and thought that this was something observable that they could find. And so people like Robert Dick, another great name in astronomy history, Dick came up with this super sensitive antenna that the guys were actually using when they identified the noise. They were just using it for radio astronomy, but Dick had created this antenna specifically to find this noise, and he was building his own and working on it when he got the call from New Jersey saying, "Hey, we heard this thing. What do you think this is?" And he was like, "Well, crap. You beat me to it." So, yeah. So there, it all happened pretty quickly once people started looking for it.
Yeah. And imagine you just turn the thing on and there it is.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of having a device, of building an antenna that could hear it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, Evan, you're going to tell us about another amazing scientific discovery, perhaps just behind that of the cosmic background radiation. And that is Animal Planet's discovery of mermaids.
Mm-hmm, that's right. It's close. I'd say it's a close second.
Which also, like background radiation, exists everywhere isotropically.
You're right, Rebecca. Yeah. You were right. I'm going to touch on that in just a moment. Now, when you think of the word mermaid, it probably invokes a very specific image in your mind. And the image you see is most likely defined by your age. Okay, so for example, if you say mermaid to a six-year-old girl in kindergarten, she's most likely to think of what? The cartoon
Little Mermaid.
Character, yeah, Ariel, right.
Definitely,
From the movie The Little Mermaid, right. Now, say mermaid to a 52-year-old housewife and mother of four, and what will she tell you?
The movie
Ariel. Also The Little Mermaid.
No, I would think the movie, right? From the early 90s, was it?
That's right. She'll tell you that it's Cher at her acting best in the movie Mermaids.
I feel like she'd still identify more with Ariel than with Cher.
If you have four-year-old kids,
I remember watching that movie, by the way, and being profoundly disappointed. I think I was like 10.
but where's the mermaids?
What? That movie was epic. The song that she sings in her cave with all her stuff, I mean, that is like awesome.
See that?
That was like the revitalization of the Disney animated feature-length movie, right?
But what if you say
mermaid? What about Daryl Hannah's mermaid?
Oh, I was totally into that too.
Splash, absolutely. Yeah. But I would say that if you ask a 45-year-old guy who works in corporate America as an IT specialist, what will they say? They'll say that it's a level one monster with 1d10 hit points and an armor class of 6.
Probably.
Okay.
But in any case, merfolk have been a part of the collective human monster manual for thousands of years, right, Rebecca? And various cultures all over the world have embraced.
What's the earliest cultural reference to a mermaid?
30,000 years ago.
Really?
Yep. Wow. According to the folks at NOAA, in fact. The belief in mermaids may have arisen at the very dawn of our species. Magical female figures first appear in cave paintings in the late Paleolithic period, some 30,000 years ago.
That's earlier than I would have thought.
Yeah, me too.
It's pretty cool, huh?
But now finally we have proof that they're actually real.
Finally, yes. This weekend, the TV channel Animal Planet aired a show called Mermaids, The New Evidence. And this show set a new record for the Animal Planet, the most watched show in the history, 17-year history of this channel. 3.6 million viewers on the initial showing. But this show from a few days ago is actually a follow-up to a show they did last year 1 year ago called Mermaids, The Body Found, which was also quite popular and caused a lot of chatter on the blogospheres and internets and everything else as to, do mermaids actually really exist?
Yeah, well, my daughter had fun debunking that. She saw that on Animal Planet.
Mm-hmm, as did mine.
Did they show a body? Like, what'd they have?
So it was Bigfoot-esque evidence.
Exactly. So Animal Planet gives you this, I've seen it referred to as a docudrama, or someone else called it speculative science fiction, which is probably the most accurate description of what it is, because it is, the whole thing, concept and everything, is entirely fiction. Now, the Animal Planet does a very good job of, I wouldn't say hiding that fact, but absolutely treating that little piece of information that it is fiction to the barest of minimum ability, in which they just put one or two little blurbs in at the end, right before the credits roll on these shows, saying, yeah, there's some fiction in here. So basically, they really skirt around the whole point of this is that it's entirely a work of fiction, but they don't make any great efforts to let the audience know that. So if you miss just a little bit, then the audience is left with making up their own mind.
Did you know that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration had to release an official statement saying that mermaids are not real? Because they were getting so many questions from people after they watched the Animal Planet episode, the original one.
Wow. That's sad for us as a species.
Yeah.
So what did they actually say, Ev?
Well, the gist of it is that evidence washed up on shore and many years ago as the government was testing new sonar devices, which was causing massive beaching of whales, right? Which is kind of sad because, you know, that probably is a phenomenon that might actually be happening. So you kind of, you know, are mixing up your stories here, but they're using that as a background to saying not only did the whales beach, but also it kicked out something that we don't know exactly what it is, but it appears to have webbed hands and webbed, you know, and a tail, and some kids stumbled upon it and they used their cell phone to record it, and they were quickly rushed away by the Navy and government, you know, men in black people. And it was, of course, perhaps the evidence, smoking gun of a mermaid. Ooh. But as I'll wrap up with this, as David Schiffman, who's one of the authors from a website called Southern Fried Science, in which they specialize in talking about oceanographic phenomenon and, you know, real science that's going on in the ocean. Someone asked him, said, what's the problem here? You know, it's good fun. You know, it's good to expand your mind and think about these things. You know, what's wrong here? So he summed it up like this. He says, why is this a problem? This displays a troubling lack of awareness of reality that is likely not limited to a belief in mermaids. He is exactly correct.
Right. Well, let's move on to a more serious news item. I'm sure you've all have heard about Angelina Jolie's editorial in the New York Times, where she described her decision to undergo a preventive double mastectomy. So she was diagnosed with a BRCA1 mutation. Now that is a gene in the BRCA. The BRCA stands for breast cancer, and it's the BRCA1 and 2 are what are known as tumor suppressor genes. They're genes for proteins that regulate DNA and keep cells from reproducing out of control. So there are certain mutations in those proteins that diminish the ability of the proteins to function properly, and people with those mutations are at increased risk of certain kinds of cancer. So she had a particular BRCA1 mutation that increased her estimated lifetime risk of developing breast cancer to 87%, and her risk of ovarian cancer to 50%. That's pretty big. That's pretty high. And her mother died of breast cancer, so this was very real for her. So she decided to have the preventive double mastectomy. So this raises some interesting issues. First, you know, her description of the care that she received is, you know, it's mostly good. I mean, she was certainly brave for just coming out and saying that she had this done, and it was definitely a science-based decision. The evidence for the risk for the BRCA1, you know, mutations is pretty solid science, and that's probably you know, the one reasonable situation where just getting a prophylactic mastectomy is a justifiable idea. A couple of little concerning things come up, though. She got her care at the Pink Lotus Breast Center, which, as you might imagine from the name, also promotes holistic type of methods. So she also, you know, was promoting, not so much, she just mentioned it in the New York Times article, but she says that, you know, her, like, holistic regimen, she'll describe elsewhere, but she is taking, you know, a bunch of supplements and homeopathic, you know, remedies along with everything else. So unfortunately, there's the woo mixed in, you know, with the science-based decision, which is unfortunate.
Luckily, it was just a bit of sort of almost like lip service.
Yeah.
Like the crux of it, at least. Like I found it really disappointing too, but at least the crux of it was like, this is what modern medicine can do. And it's
right.
Amazing,
and let's waste some money on some other nonsense. That is nothing. Right. Yeah. Some people have brought up the fact that, you know, well, she's sort of describing her experience as a way of empowering women to not be afraid and you know, get tested and do what needs to be done and not feel like it makes them less of a woman. And that's all fantastic. But you do have to also realize that she is fabulously wealthy. You know, she can afford to pay for these tests.
She talks about that too.
She mentions herself, yeah, that just the yeah. test itself is expensive and many women don't really have that option. It costs like $3,000 to get the genetic screen. But also the surgeries are expensive and may not be covered preventively. There's a range of options for reconstructive surgery after mastectomy. I mean, and at the high end, yeah, the results can be, you know, absolutely amazing. So, you know, I'm sure she had in the absolute high end of options here because she can afford to. So she does, I think she does seem to understand that just from what she wrote in her editorial, but I don't know if she fully appreciates what her advice would mean to the average woman in a similar situation who doesn't have millions of dollars to explore their options. You know what
no,
I mean?
No, I think she does though. The fact that she does bring up the problem of the expense of it and the fact that low-income women's healthcare just isn't adequate for this sort of thing. I think the whole reason why she wrote this was, well, maybe not the whole reason, but a huge part of the reason is to make people realize that, you know, this is something that can be done, that can save, you know, many lives, and that could be very important to consider when we're talking about making more healthcare options open to more women.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I do think, yeah, she's confronting this issue. And she does mention that, you know, she wants women to know that they have options. But again, a lot of people have pointed out that, yes, this is all great, but they won't necessarily have all the options that you had.
And I think that's good. I think, and I do, like, again, I think that that's part of her point is that that discussion needs to happen. Like, we need to talk about why wealthy women have access to this stuff and other women don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And David Gorski raised a point as well. So David Gorski, who blogs for me over at Science Based Medicine, he he's a breast cancer surgeon. This is what he does. And he wrote in a good article about it too on Science Based Medicine and on his other blog as well. And he, you know, he brought up a point that he actually, as a breast cancer surgeon, is often under a lot of pressure from women to get mastectomies, even when lumpectomies might suffice, that often women facing breast cancer act out of fear. You know, it's a very difficult thing to face, you know, facing the big C, right? Facing cancer.
Right.
He thinks, his impression is that patients are more likely to request a mastectomy than the surgeon is. So the patients are pushing it for it, even when the surgeons may be saying, you don't need a full mastectomy. You know, we could probably get away with just a lumpectomy. And also, you know, some women push for a double mastectomy, basically taking off the other breast prophylactically when there's really no evidence that it enhances survival. So his concern was that, again, while it's great that Angelina Jolie is coming out with her experience here, you know, and raising awareness of the options here, that it may further increase this sort of patient demand for prophylactic or bilateral mastectomy or more aggressive procedures when it's not absolutely necessary. Because that's really already patients are shifted more in that direction than they need to be. So that's interesting. It's sort of an unintended consequence.
I was surprised by how many, like the response to her article, I was surprised by how many people seem to have never heard of the mutation or the prophylactic, you know, mastectomy. Because it was something that I just thought was common knowledge, but apparently isn't.
So to make it crystal clear for our listeners, what should a woman do if she's concerned, and what's a good course of action?
So, yeah, I mean, if you're concerned, get tested. First of all, just consult with your physician. It's reasonable to get, especially if you have like a strong family history, to get tested. Hopefully you have good insurance that can pay for it. The difficult part would be, you know, if you're a woman who doesn't have good insurance, who can't really afford to, you know, lay down $3,000 in cash to get the genetic testing done, what do you do? I don't know. I mean, your options are limited at that point. You would talk to your physician, see if they have any ideas to offer you. Probably, you know, there's a good case to be made for insurance companies covering this.
Yeah, and you know, you might check Planned Parenthood, because I know Planned Parenthood recently launched a huge program, I think last year, to equip more clinics to do more breast cancer screening things, including genetic testing. So.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, of course, the cranks come out of the woodwork when any kind of. The worst of which is Mike Adams from Natural News.
God, that guy.
Yeah, he's just, you know, he's so despicable. So he's now accusing Angelina Jolie of unnecessarily mutilating herself, of removing healthy tissue for no reason.
That guy's loathsome.
He's loathsome. Christ. He's saying that she chose to have unnecessary surgery rather than just lead a healthy anti-cancer lifestyle. Because he claims that even if you have these genetic mutations, you won't get cancer if you lead this quote unquote healthy anti-cancer lifestyle. And he'll sell you CDs that will tell you how to do that.
Yeah. So he's not motivated by anything other than just caring for people, Steve.
Yeah.
Right.
He's the worst of the worst, because even the lip service she paid to Natural Remedies wasn't enough for him. Like, the way she did it is the way that I think if you have somebody in your life who is into alternative medicine, that's the kind of person you want them to be like, is the Angelina Jolie type, where she has a doctor and, you know, the doctor is aware of what other quote unquote natural things you're doing in addition to the actual course of action recommended by your doctor. Like, that is fine. Do that. But Mike Adams is pushing this complete BS stuff that's going to actually murder people. Like, give up the real medicine in favor of this BS that I'm going to sell you.
Here's his logic. He writes, "With this logic, abortions are cancer prevention too, because those babies might one day grow up to develop tumors. Better to kill them early and prevent cancer, right?"
God. Wow.
Jeez. That's aggravated anti-intellectualism.
Yeah, like, aggravated idiocy.
Yeah, like, he's really trying there to go against, you know, science at that point. What a complete jackass.
He's a complete jackass. Yeah, I agree. It's terrible. And interestingly, just as an aside here, I noticed during all of this, this is a Brad Jelena news item, because Brad Pitt, while all of this was going down, gave an interview in which he described his lifelong struggle with prosopagnosia, which is interesting in and of itself. I was wondering if the timing of that was coincidental, or maybe he was just trying, I don't know, take some heat off of his girlfriend.
Well, I don't think it was coincidental, because he talks about her decision as well.
Yeah. So, we know somebody else who has what so-called developmental prosopagnosia.
We do?
So they tell us.
I mean, if they can be believed, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I make a lot of money in the fake prosopagnosia games.
Yeah, that's the whole goal.
It is.
So Rebecca, you first noticed this when you were a child?
No, because I didn't know I needed glasses until I randomly mentioned to my mother that I couldn't see something in the distance, you know, and I just didn't realize that that's not how normal people saw. So it's the same sort of thing. I didn't realize I had it until in my 20s, and I stumbled across a website where somebody was describing it. I don't even know how I got to the website, but it was like the choir from heaven, you know, like the clouds parting.
That moment.
Yeah, it was.
Yep. When you realize, oh, this is me.
Yeah, it was amazing. Like, so many, I bought into this idea that I was just a jerk. I just couldn't be bothered to remember people, even if I really, really wanted to. But yeah, no, it turns out that.
Yeah. So just to make sure our listeners know what we're talking about, is that prosopagnosia is the inability or a deficit in the ability to recognize faces.
Yeah. And mine's a deficit, not a complete inability. So if I have met someone a number of times, or if I've just seen them a number of times, like actors and stuff, I can totally recognize them. But as an example, I lived with a guy for 3 years. We were dating and living together, and he picked me up from work one day, and he had shaved his head and his goatee. And he was sitting in the car outside, and I went to get in the car, and I opened the door, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And I shut the door. and then I stopped and I turned around and I'm like, wait a minute. And then I realized it was my boyfriend. Like, I had no idea because I had just come to, like, because I can't remember faces very well. And apparently even somebody I'd been living with for several years, you just learn to recognize people by other
by their features, yeah.
Yeah.
By focusing on
the way they dress,
features.
The way voice. They talk, mm-hmm. yeah. Things
yeah,
like
so,
that.
And you're, that's typical, that, cause I've been doing some reading on it. Just, there's a couple of research centers that research prosopagnosia, and many people with the, cause there's acquired and developmental. Acquired is like from strokes. It's very rare to get brain damage precisely to that part of the brain. So most people with it have a so-called developmental prosopagnosia, and many of them don't realize it until they're adults because, as you say, it's normal for them. This is what, this is their life. They don't notice that anything's wrong. So Brad Pitt was saying that people just think he's a jerk, just like what you were saying. They think that always like being, you know, high and mighty actors is too much of a jerk to remember people. So he decided to just tell people that, you know, he can't recognize faces and that, you know, you need to give me context. You need to tell me how I know you. But he said that people get even more mad at him when he started being honest with them about the fact that he can't remember them.
I started doing that as well after I realized, you know, this is an actual thing and it has a name, an impressive sounding name.
Yeah.
I started doing that and I found the opposite of Brad Pitt, that people are totally cool with it. Like at first they demur, like it happens most often at conferences. People be like, you know, come up and introduce themselves to me. And if I suspect that I'm going to meet them again later, I'll tell them, like, look, I'm terrible at faces. And they'll always say, like, oh, well, that's just because you meet so many people. And I'm like, no, it's this thing, prosopagnosia. And once I explain it, people find it really interesting. And everybody, like, I've never had anybody think that I'm just like hiding the fact that I'm a jerk.
Maybe it's the skeptical versus the Hollywood culture that we're.
Maybe. I don't know.
Rebecca, if I were your boyfriend, I'd wear the same t-shirt every day so you knew it was me.
I would appreciate that, Jay. I think Adam probably does do things like that. I don't know.
Jay, that's very nice, but when am I getting my flying car?
Well, Steve, that's a good question. Because people have been trying to create the flying car since...
Not a good question.
It is. It's fascinating. I'd love to talk about this. It's been the big promise from many companies and science fiction for a long time, right? Like, think of it. It goes back to 1917 when the first attempt was made by a man named Glenn Curtis, and this guy happened to be one of the rivals of the Wright brothers, who was also developing airplanes at the time. So his Curtis autoplane failed, and it was only able to kind of hop a little bit. It couldn't get sustained flight. And it took another 20 years past that for the next real airworthy flying car to be built in 1937. And that actually could fly. And now, you know, tons of failures all along the way. Moving forward to the 1950s, the flying car was part of that era of science fiction, right? You guys can visualize the science fiction graphics and illustrations that people made back then. The flying car was very much a part of all of that. People really did think it was going to be coming soon in the future, and it never came. And a lot of the problems that people hit, you know, 50 years ago, we're still hitting today. So throughout all these companies trying to develop a flying car without success, there has been some moderate success stories, and there's several companies working on them today, including DARPA, who is trying to develop one right now, with a goal of 2015 of having a vehicle that would be ready for use. But one of the companies I want to talk about today as just a way to start the conversation is companies called Terrafugia. And Terra Fugia was founded in 2006 with the sole purpose of developing a flying car. And they've been fine-tuning their first design, and it went through a couple of unexpected, I wouldn't say emergency, but they did a test, and then they realized that they had to retool it and re-engineer to get rid of problems. And it went through two rounds of that. So now they're on their third design. And they're saying that the first delivery will be in either early 2015 or all the way to mid-2016. And that car is called the Transition. And it's based on the idea of a roadworthy car that can easily deploy wings and take off like a normal airplane. And there's different kinds of flying car concepts. There's the kind where the wings and maybe the tail section detach. So it's looks like more of a real car. Or like a small, light-looking car that gets an attachment connected onto maybe one or more places. However, Terra Fugia's cars and their ideas are self-contained, meaning that the wings will fold in and it doesn't need to drop off any components anywhere. So they're, like I said, their car, the Transition, you can't take this thing off in your driveway or, you know, from a long street. Like, you need to go to a real airport with a runway and you need a pilot's license to fly this. So this is a real airplane that just happens to be streetworthy after the wings fold in. Now, this company that I mentioned already, Terra Fugia, has already come up with the next model, and it's called the TFX. And this is a vertical takeoff and landing vehicle similar to the Bell Boeing V-22 Osprey. I thought it was funny earlier in the show, Steve, when you mentioned the Osprey, because you ever see that? It's a twin rotor helicopter slash kind of airplane-y looking thing.
That's right. It's like a helicopter when you take off, but then it contorts itself and it turns into a jet, like the
two engines. Airplane. Like if you hold your two hands up next to your head and you point your palms up at the ceiling, imagine those are the blades. And then now bring your hands and point forward. And what happens is that's where the blades go. That's where like the two helicopter like rotators like move into position to help propel the vehicle forward. That's a similar design that they're using with the TFX, except when it gets up to, flight speed, those propellers turn off and it uses a gas powered internal engine. That's a 300 horsepower combustion engine. It's using two 600 horsepower electric motors, however, to take off and land, which I think is pretty cool. So the machine itself is somewhat of a hybrid concoction here. Batteries are really heavy, and battery technology today actually isn't up to snuff yet.
No, not even close.
They're developing this model, and they think that their design is going to see fruition or come to be a reality in 8 to 12 years. And that's even past the typical 5 year. It's coming. It'll be here in 5 years that we hear all the time in science and exploratory things. 8 to 12 years means it could be never.
Yeah, it means they have no idea. There's major technological hurdles here. I mean, they have this CGI animated video of this flying car, you know, taking off and flying around. It would be cool if it worked as what they're showing on that video, but it's fantasy land. I mean, they can't demonstrate that they can produce that kind of thrust. That the thrust that something that size and the size of those motors and the power that they're going to have in their batteries and gas and engine and fuel tank is going to be able to lift the resulting machine. I mean, the one thing won't necessarily be able to get off the ground, and its range could be negligible, like 10 minutes. Right now, what they're showing, it's not like they have a design. All they have to do is build it. What they have now is a fantasy. And the numbers don't even add up yet. It's like, if we have some imaginary super advanced battery technology or maybe even, material, super light materials or whatever. I don't know what the hell they're thinking.
Well, it's not that much fantasy. Like, there is definitely future technology that they're banking on. They're trying to converge their design with future materials and future battery technology.
I think it's a fantasy.
I think it's a risky venture. It's risky. But, you know, Steve, also think about it too. Even though people are investing in this company largely because they want a return, I'm sure that 99.999% of the people like absolutely want to see a return on the money. It is an investment in future technology. The technology is not going to just go by the wayside if the company fails. You know, they could sell off things that they've developed to other companies.
No, but Jay, I'm not against people with money dumping and investing money into this kind of project. You know, please build me my flying car. I absolutely want one. But just that.
Yes.
It's not like we're in any kind of path to the vehicle that they are showing in their animation. The technology doesn't exist. And there are some real problems with just the numbers, the physics. It doesn't quite add up yet. And also, you know, the other thing about the video is it's silent. There's no sound. A lot of people are saying that there's just an inherent problem with the vertical takeoff concept, because you have to use essentially some helicopter type technology. You have to use blades. You don't have anti-grav yet, right? Yeah. Once you have anti-grav, then all bets are off. It's going to be really noisy, and there's going to be this massive downdraft to get the thing off the ground. And that's a significant practical limitation of where you're going to take off and land.
Yeah. I would think that a short runway flying car would be a better option. It uses less fuel. You know, it's a difference between like the space shuttle taking off vertically versus a space plane that could take off like an airplane.
Yeah. Short runway might be better than the vertical takeoff. I mean, it depends on what you want in a flying car. Like the transition model that you were talking about. Yeah. That's not a flying car. That's a plane that can fold up its wings and drive, but it's not really a flying car because you need a pilot's license and you need an airport. That's a plane. In my book, if you need a pilot's license at an airport, that's a plane.
Yeah.
Flying car is something you can take off from your driveway and you don't need a pilot's license to operate.
I feel like you would still need a pilot's license though. I agree with you about the airport thing and, you know, the runway problem, but I think once there's a viable car that will fly through the air, there are going to have to be laws that restrict its use and you will need to get a special license.
Oh, absolutely.
Rebecca, yeah, let's talk about what the company says and then we can chit chat about all of that. So one thing that they were saying is in order for this to really work, the drivers don't need to be fully piloted or fully licensed pilots. That they need to be trained. They said it's going to take like 5-hour training. Ultimately, what this means is it's all computer driven. Like you're pushing buttons.
Yeah.
You're going to tell it where you want to go. And if there's an emergency, you're going to have to know like, okay, it's going to deploy a ballistic parachute if there's a problem. And there might be a couple of things that you have to do under that extreme circumstance. But for the most part, you can't expect the average person to have any kind of real flying skills. So we're talking about, you know, Google, like the driver, the computer driven car that Google's doing, but for the air. That's what we're really talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the easy part. That we're already there. Having computers fly the thing so that you don't need a license, that, you know, you could just tell it where you want to go. That's the easy part. And, you know, they are talking about, you know, there are different levels of operation, like manual operation, you need a license. Operate, you know, flying on instruments, you need a license. But just flying on fully computer, you know, operated automatic mode, you know, a chimpanzee can do it. I mean,
but can the average American?
Yeah. But I mean, we're actually already there in terms of the computer technology and the navigation systems. That's not the hurdle anymore. The hurdle is the same hurdle we've had for 100 years. It's just the physics of getting enough lift with the, you know, with the fuel and everything. It's just a problem. You know,
I don't think we are quite there though, just because maybe you're talking there's a huge difference, I think, between a driverless car and a driverless plane. There's an extra dimension, and also there's an existing infrastructure and law system that the cars can adhere to. And
I've heard some people say that that flying is actually easier for the computer than driving on the roads. There's a lot less stuff to navigate around and negotiate.
Well, but not when you're taking off from your driveway and you're surrounded by power lines and there's, you know, other planes and there's restricted airspace.
But I'm saying, I think we're a lot closer to having that. Will just be like, we could say, oh yeah, if we just develop the software, the systems already exist, the computers are already powerful enough. We've already worked out most of the basic technology, just adapting it to a flying car. To me, that's the easiest thing to accomplish of all the things you have to accomplish to make an actual flying car.
One more quick thing too. When you have a vehicle that's in the air, you need the maintenance to go way up. You can't have it be like an old clunker on the road. You know, you're going to have to, the cost for repair and all that is going to skyrocket. There's going to be a ton of man hours that have to go into that. And a lot of people are going to need to be trained to be able to repair these vehicles and do checks and everything. You know, just everything gets more complicated.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's coming. It's coming. It'll come. I mean, I'm sure within 50 years we'll have something.
All right.
5 to 10. Probably,
I might be good for 50 years. But
Evan, you know what time it is.
Who's That Noisy time?
Yep.
We had a puzzle last week for Who's That Noisy, and I will tell it to you again. Here we go. A bank teller made a mistake today. The teller switched the dollars and cents when they cashed a check for Mrs. Jones, giving her dollars instead of cents and cents instead of dollars. After buying a newspaper for 5 cents, Mrs. Jones realized she had remaining exactly twice as much as the original check. So based on that information, what was the amount of the original check? A lot of people had to dust off some old math skills in order to figure this one out.
It's just algebra.
That is really all it is. The correct answer is $31.63 is the correct answer. And yeah, lots of ways you could arrive at that answer. Some people created clever spreadsheets. Other people wrote on the back of cocktail napkins at the bar. Although there were lots of correct answers, there can be only one winner. And that goes to, from the message boards, Mr. Pedantic.
Mr. Pedantic.
That's how you say that word.
That's his name. Mm-hmm. Mr. Pedantic.
That guy again, huh?
Yeah. Shows up often.
Evan, what do you got for this week?
Yes, so we're going back to the classic Who's That Noisy? I'm going to play a sound for you. If you are ready, here we go.
So I went to the bookstore the following day after this much-involved conversation, and the books fell out on the floor in front of me. And I picked them up, and there are lights all over them. And so this is when I learned about Edgar Cayce, and I learned about a few people that I'd never heard of in my life. And
if you would like to give us a guess, the email address for Who's That Noisy Answers is wtn@theskepticsguide.org. And of course, our forums is sguforums.com. Give us your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
Alrighty. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
We're just going to do one quick email this week. This one comes from Adam Dietrich from the United States, and he writes, "Something I've been hearing about a lot lately, and living in Portland, that means every day, is that raw honey is of great benefit to the health. Everything from being a cancer cure, obviously bullshit, to a treatment for allergies, somewhat less obvious. While I have heard of its topical antibiotic properties and its use as a cough suppressant and relief for a sore throat, I wasn't sure how much of what is said about honey is actually true. Would the SGU have any insight?" Well, for our listeners who are not in the United States, who may not be familiar, Portland, Oregon is definitely in the epicenter of holistic woo in the U.S.
Mm. One of them, yep.
Yeah, not surprising. Yeah, one of them. Actually, just a community in Oregon, was it Portland, that just voted down fluoridated water. The anti-fluoridationists had their way.
They had their win.
Yeah, unfortunately. So, yeah, raw honey. Who knew that, honey, all honey wasn't raw?
Organic honey.
It's organic raw honey. So
must be good for you.
Sometimes, often, honey manufacturers will heat it up to 70 degrees Celsius to kill off things like bacteria and fungus. But if you want to be one with Mother Earth, you want the fungus and the bacteria because it's all natural. In fact, I read an article, about researching this item, they identified two new candida species from raw honey. They're discovering new species of fungus in raw honey.
I looked up some of the things that they say it's good for.
Oh, yeah. It's good for what else? Yeah, of course.
Everything.
I'm going to ignore the simple ones, like it's good for sore throats and laryngitis and things that are, won't kill you probably. It's good for bladder infections. Very, very bad to ignore a bladder infection. It's upset stomach or bad stomach pain or bad breath. Bad breath could be a significant sign of tooth decay, and tooth decay, it could be a precursor to a lot of other bad things.
Like heart health-wise. Disease.
Yeah, like heart disease is an example. They're saying to eat raw local honey because the local bees are going to be in tune with your local situation. I don't even want to continue on that one.
Yeah. No, that's the only one. I used to buy into that, and that made perfect sense to me. And it does, I think it makes really good, folk sense, whatever you would call that. So the idea is that your local bees go out and they pollinate all of the local plants, including the things that are causing your allergies. So, by eating the local honey, you're getting a little bit of what's causing allergies. And in the way that people might think that vaccines work, then you vaccinate yourself against allergens. I totally believed that when I was younger.
Yeah, no, there is a little thread that you could consider to be not completely idiotic there, but it's wrong. bleeding gums, stomach aches, and migraines. They were saying that that you could put it on like wounds, like actual wounds.
So there's a little bit of truth to that, Jay. That honey doesn't have to be raw, just honey. And we talked about this. And Mark Crislip wrote an article about it actually on Science-Based Medicine. Actually, it does kill bacteria. It's an unfriendly environment for bacteria, and it is a poor man's kind of topical antiseptic. So if you can rub it into a wound, and it will be fine.
Yeah, but Steve, what are we living on that game show? You know, where we're on an island. You know, like come on.
Yeah, I'm saying. Yeah, I mean, I would rather use actual medicine. But
yeah, you go to the pharmacy and get a Band-Aid and some bacitracin ointment or some type of antibiotic. Like, don't use honey to put on cuts on your body. That's ridiculous.
Well, it's not your first choice.
Well, James, I'm saying, yeah, it's not your. It wouldn't be my first choice, but there's actually some rationale to that, and it can actually work.
So yeah, like if you're on a camping trip or something, and you get a scratch.
But the evidence is weak. The evidence, the published, you know, peer-reviewed evidence is weak, but it's not implausible. And the allergy one, I've been trying to find some published evidence on that too, and I can only find like preliminary, small, basically worthless studies. But again, it's not completely crazy because at least you're getting exposed to pollen and, you know, that could theoretically affect your allergic reaction. But again, it's kind of a thin argument and the evidence isn't there. Everything else is crap. Everything else is just made up holistic nonsense, you know, treating any disease with it.
Rub a Tootsie Roll on your frickin' wound next time. Yeah, get out of here with that.
Well, let's move on to our interview. Joining us now are Vijay Dewan and Scott Thurman. Vijay and Scott, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Yeah.
And Vijay, you are the producer, one of the producers of the movie The Revisionaries. And Scott, you are the director. This is a movie about Don McElroy, who we interviewed a couple weeks ago. You were kind enough to help set that up with us as well. So tell us about the movie, The Revisionaries. What's it about? Why did you do it?
I guess around 2007, I started becoming interested in evolution education. I had my finger on the pulse of the Four Horsemen, you know, the atheists, sort of reading a few of their books and seeing a lot of their stuff online. I was particularly interested in Dan Dennett and sort of his philosophy. I was interested in following an educator. I wanted to follow a science teacher teaching about evolution in Texas, but not just the evolution instruction. I wanted that person to talk more candidly out of the classroom about the sort of philosophical implications of evolution, and came across news articles, national news, talking about the State Board of Education at that time. So I decided to sort of do a sort of dual portrait of a teacher, a science teacher, and the State Board of Education. But as time went by, I got more and more sucked into the politics, the politicization of education, of science education. You know, seeing the national news reports and everything, I knew that that particular story would have a bigger audience than my little portrait of a science teacher. Mm-hmm. I mean, originally my idea was to encourage the good rather than discourage the bad. And I sort of went full sell on that whole thing, leaving any sort of positive, maybe science positive role model in the classroom for someone that might be considered anti-science, like Don McElroy. As time went by, the social studies and history standards came up, and we ended up doing half science, half social studies because, you know, as I was finishing up my thesis film, which was more devoted towards the science end of this, I got a call from one of the guys, you know, that would watch the Board of Education, and he said, you know, Scott, the social studies has ended up being more controversial than the science. And I thought, how in the world is that possible? And sure enough, it was. And so I continued to follow that with the sort of help and guidance from Vijay and some of the other producers, and the rest is history.
For me, actually, it was a little bit different of a journey. But it was mainly after college. The first book I really read was The Elegant Universe, and from that really opened my mind to science and science education. And I got into your podcast, and it was really the early interviews you guys did with Eugenie Scott, Steve Schaeffersman, Ken Miller, and a bunch of the other people involved with the Texas Board of Education that got me really fired up, and I just felt like I really wanted to do something about this. I reached out to a couple of my friends who were into filmmaking, and I didn't even know Scott prior to this film. We saw some videos he put up on YouTube, contacted him, my friend flew out to Texas, and the rest was history.
And the movie really spends a lot of time with Don McElroy, sort of his character and how that drove the whole process. So tell us a little bit about that.
So Don, I tell people, is completely different when you read about what he's done versus seeing and watching him, his behavior, especially in the context of his personal life. And that was really the reason why I decided to follow him in his sort of everyday routine at the dentist office and church, and greatly surprised by the amount of access that he was willing to give to us in his trust. And I say at first, in reading his articles, and what he was doing, I was outraged. I was on a mission to go and find this guy and expose him for what he was doing and show it to the world. And in a way, that sort of is, you know, there was a little bit of exposing sort of his maybe underlining beliefs or sort of what may lie behind his motivation against evolution. But one thing happened in making this project, and that was that changed everything. And that was that I got to know Don McElroy for who he was, the really kind of kind uncle grandpa figure that I often find myself defending after the movie to audiences that, you know, are very aggressive science advocates and see the damage that he's done to science education and are infuriated, you know. And so yeah. I found myself sort of defending him often because I felt like maybe I had not done enough to show on a personal level how much of a genuinely kind person I think that he is. And for me, this isn't necessarily a story just about science education or the political issue or the politicization of science education. It's a story at the forefront about characters, specifically Don McElroy, about the person Don McElroy. And his, you know, interesting, I'm fascinated by how someone can, I've never met anyone that's tried seemingly so hard to understand evolution, yet only really see his perspective confirmed in what he reads. So, I mean, the guy really, really tries hard to understand these concepts, and maybe to people who've studied this their whole lives, they laugh it off and know exactly sort of his motivation behind what he's doing. But I firmly believe he genuinely wants to understand, and I'll never forget, he told me when I first met him, he read Kenneth Miller's Only a Theory, and he said that was the closest he came to appreciating and understanding, or at least accepting, evolution. And, you know, I thought, oh God, I've got to talk to Ken Miller about this and see if he can write another book, Only a Theory Part 2 or something. You know, I think he can be convinced. And all the while we played this game, I was trying to convince him, he was trying to convince me, until one day I just let the cameras roll. I was just going to record what he had to say and just let it roll and let everything come out. And, you know, my editor kind of gave the comment, you know, we'll give him enough rope to hang himself. Well, Don, to other people, may look like he's sort of, you know, making mistakes or revealing sort of different motivations behind what he's trying to do against evolution. But to him, he really does see who he is for what he is. And he's seen this movie and, you know, for the most part, in terms of the treatment of his character, he really likes it and appreciates it. And we still talk to this day about the movie. And so with that access that he gave me, I had the added responsibility to treat him fairly. And I have to say, I greatly admired the level of access that he was giving me. And, you know, we wanted to show a portrait of him, warts and all. And he allowed that. And he's got to be praised for allowing that and coming out and not being a politician about it all and being cagey and saying one thing to one group of people and hiding and using code words with another. I think maybe you could argue he tries to use code words and it just doesn't come out, or he's not able to do that. But the bottom line is, I think he's a very sincere person who's trying to fight science against science. I mean, he's trying to use scientific arguments so much as he understands them. And I think he's genuine. I think there are some slightly ingenuine aspects about him, but I think overall he's a great person who's not the best person for the Board of Education.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a couple of lessons here. One is that is the power of motivated reasoning and confirmation bias. I mean, he is seeing everything through a pretty thick filter.
Right.
He thinks because he can come up with an argument against evolution, that means, well, there must be a problem with evolution, sort of underestimating, which is like most people do, how creative we can be in coming up with explanations. Just the very fact that he sees the revisionaries, he sees the documentary and likes the way he's portrayed. You know, if you think about it, if you just try to watch the movie from the filter, from the perspective of a Christian who believes in creationism and thinks evolution is wrong, well, then everything is cast in a different light. You know, then all of his antics seem positive instead of negative. The other thing, you know, that really comes out, and the point you were making, that, you know what, it surprised you that he was a genuine nice guy. But that is something that we find pretty universally, except for, I mean, there are some true evil con artists out there, but, you know, that aside, most of the true believers that we deal with, whatever side of whatever, you know, controversy they're on, most of them are sincere, regular people. You know, that they're just wrong in some way. There's some major or massive flaw in the way that they're approaching the subject matter. But we tend to create these icons, you know, these sort of cardboard notions of people. And
right.
But no, that's just not true. These are just real people with, you know, just regular people, you know?
And I felt by highlighting that, by getting past the caricature of what so many articles had done with him, I felt that real sort of quality of him as a human being with good and bad traits would ring more true and in a way, I think, further legitimize the credibility of the portrait. Mm-hmm. So that people maybe on the other side of the fence can't say, oh, well, you know, he merely made that guy look like a fool, which still they do anyway. But I think there are some people in the middle politically that see that fairness and yeah. appreciate it and will hopefully be more understanding of the scientific principles that they might be against prior yeah. to that, or at least be aggravated by films that only, you know, intend to caricature and provide a real surface sort of perspective of these people.
Just coming from my angle, I grew up in the Northeast, and I actually, growing up, never met a creationist in my life. Everyone I knew believed in evolution. I didn't even really understand that was an issue until law school at Notre Dame, and I met a few people at Notre Dame who were very smart, very nice people who didn't believe in evolution, and it blew my mind. So coming to this project and meeting Scott, I really appreciated the fact that he created this three-dimensional picture of who Don was rather than a caricature of who a lot of people think he is, because I think a lot of people on our side have that two-dimensional character in their head of who creationists are, and we wanted to be really true to who Don was and mm-hmm. show people the full story.
Yeah, Don was a soundbite. You know, someone's got to stand up to those experts. Like, that's all you see of him. Then that's what you think. You know, you don't see the full, more complicated person behind that statement. And it's also, you know, again, the lesson that we have to keep, I think, bringing up over and over again is that everyone thinks they're the hero. Everyone is the hero of their own narrative.
Yeah.
You know, no one thinks that they're the villain. And What's interesting,
unless they have a mustache.
Yeah, unless they're a psychopathic con artist, and they're out there too. But for the, and even then, they probably rationalize it some way as well. But, you know, and it, also, you know, we've been doing this long enough where we've seen it turned around against us. You know, we've been attacked by our, you know, ideological opponents who try to caricature us. And you could tell they don't think that we're real people. They just see the iconic villain narrative that they've made us into. And so I think it really is a very important lesson that, you know, most people are just people.
Yeah, I guess, you know, most people see that and they're like, yeah, but who cares? I mean, the science is the science. And I quote a lot on this, or at least I send a link out to a lot of people often, this moment at a TED Talk where Neil deGrasse Tyson sort of confronted Richard Dawkins about how, you know, his abrasive tone may shed people away. And Dawkins said, well, basically, he quoted some guy and said, I don't give a damn, you know, science is the science. And I think what was important that Neil deGrasse Tyson had to say was that the communication of science is not only the information and the facts, but the sensitivity to a person's beliefs. And if we want to be effective communicators of science, I think the old days of saying, well, no, they're just going to have to accept the facts and everybody's going to come around someday. Well, I think we can get to that day a lot faster if we have great communicators of science.
I don't think it's a coincidence that all of my favorite science communicators have a phenomenal tone and compassion and, you know, just a peacefulness about the way that they talk. It's rare when you get a Jeannie Scott or a Carl Sagan come along and they you want to listen to them and I could listen to both of them speak for hours and I love what they're saying, how they're saying it, and their effect on me.
Quickly, I want to respond to, you know, the idea of being fair. I think we have to be very careful, and I got pressed on this by a lot of the science community after the film, in that we're comparing apples and oranges, science and non-science. I wasn't intending to be fair to the non-scientific perspectives, as to speak, but rather the character treatment is what I wanted to be fair about.
Unfortunately, it's not a new problem. I think that's something that has plagued the sort of skeptic community for a very long time. I've heard this exact same story from John Ronson, for instance. He wrote the book Them, Adventures with Extremists, which is, I think, one of the greatest books a skeptic could pick up, because what he does, if, for those who aren't familiar with the book, John befriends quote-unquote extremists, people who have very strange beliefs and take them to the nth level. And he has adventures with them and he writes about them. And he had a really hard time at first sort of being accepted amongst skeptics because, they would be critical of him for not shouting at these people, for not, for befriending them. And I think it's a shame that that's what our rhetoric is these days. It's hit the point of this very black and white sort of, you're right, they're wrong kind of feeling. And I think it's important that people like you guys and people like John are out there, continuing to humanize the quote unquote other side, because, so long as we other them, we're never, if we can't identify with the other side, there's no possible way we can ever change their minds.
Exactly.
And I think it's a matter of strategy. I think everyone has their role. I think, you know, this, I think, goes back to the Dawkins, Neil deGrasse Tyson debate. And Richard Dawkins is really great at solidifying people's beliefs. And I think Neil deGrasse Tyson is great at bringing people over. And I think you need both.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I that's why I tell people there's the Michael Moore approach and then there's the Scott Thurman approach.
So our listeners can see The Revisionaries on Netflix if they have it. They can go to your website, therevisionariesmovie.com, and they could get the DVD, or can they watch it, stream it directly online?
Yeah, it used to be on PBS. I think that's no longer available, but it may be in the future. I'm not 100% certain about that.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us. It was a really great interview.
Thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. For this week, we have a theme. Last year, if you recall, there was the top 10 species discovered in 2011. So this year, we have the list of the top 10 species discovered in 2012.
Top but it's 10. May, June. It's June.
It took them a while.
It just came out. Just came out.
What have they been doing the past 6 months?
It's like the Academy.
Looking at species.
Arts, you know?
What the hell? Steve, seriously, I'm not doing this.
Okay, here we go. Item number one. The species is Lucy Hormetica Luci. A new species of cockroach that glows in the dark has been identified, but may already be extinct. Item number two. Chondrocladia Lyra. A large, harp-shaped carnivorous sponge that feeds on fish and crustaceans has been discovered in the Pacific. And item number three, Paedophrine anamnensis, the world's smallest vertebrate, has been discovered, a 7-millimeter frog from New Guinea.
All right, so what's the deal with this now? What are we trying to do here?
So two.
Which one's the top?
Two of these are real species that were discovered in the last year, and one is not. See how that works?
The one not ever doesn't exist at all?
Well, or whatever. One of them is fiction, Jay. You got to figure it out.
Come on.
Why don't you go first?
Okay, the first one about the glow-in-the-dark cockroach. I mean, didn't they make a glow-in-the-dark cockroach? So there were some wacky, weird glow-in-the-dark cockroaches that weren't made in the lab. And this one about the harp-shaped sponge that feeds on fish, that's pretty cool. If that's real, that would be awesome. Like, and does he play him a song like while he's killing him? And then the 7-millimeter frog. Now, he's awesome. Okay, I'm going to say that the glow-in-the-dark cockroach is the fake.
Okay, Evan?
Yeah, this is an exercise in guessing, I suppose.
Unless you're fluent in Latin.
I'm not. I'm fluent in Gungan, though.
Gungan?
Misa's skeptic.
How many years have you been waiting to say that, Evan?
All right, so the cockroach may already be extinct. You think of a cockroach surviving a nuclear catastrophe and, you know, a glow-in-the-dark cockroach doesn't seem all that crazy an idea. Next one about the harp-shaped carnivorous sponge, SpongeBob square harp, that feeds on fish and crustaceans, discovered in the Pacific. Nothing special about that. The last one is the frog, 7 millimeters. That's small. Jay, I'm going with you. I'm with you with the cockroach. That one is the fiction.
Good man.
And Rebecca.
Yeah, I like the idea of a carnivorous sponge. I like the idea of any angry, inanimate object murdering things. So that one, definitely science. And also, your little thing about the Latin. All right, lyra means harp. So maybe that one's true. Smallest vertebrate, pedophrine. Pedo. Yeah, I believe that. I believe that there's a tiny frog that was discovered. So yeah, the cockroach. First of all, that wouldn't have been one of the top animals discovered in 2012. If it's already extinct, that's dumb. That wouldn't make the top. So that's the first thing that makes me suspicious of that. Although I can believe that if there was a cockroach that glowed in the dark, it would go extinct because, you know, cockroach, their whole thing is, you know, they come out into your kitchen in the dark, and when you turn on the lights, they all scatter. Yeah. So if it glowed in the dark, you'd be able to spray it with the bug spray before you even turn on the light. So, dead. So yeah, I'm gonna.
They check
I'm gonna
in.
Agree with Jay and Evan though that that one is BS.
But they don't.
It's gonna be epic or horrible, Steve. Give it to us straight.
All right, well, let's take these in reverse order then, since you guys all chose number one. Let's start with the world's smallest vertebrate has been discovered: a 7-millimeter frog from New Guinea. You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science. It's not every year that you get to discover the smallest vertebrate. The last winner was a cyprinid fish in 2006, was the last title holder of smallest vertebrate. This adult frog averages in length, both males and females, about 7.7 millimeters, with few exceptions. This has been found in association with moist leaf litter in tropical wet forests. So it's got a very narrow niche. There's a picture of it sitting on a dime. It's like dwarfed by a dime.
Oh, I remember that. Okay, now that you mentioned that, I remember a picture of a frog on a dime. Okay.
Yeah, these are all from, you know, over the last year, so you might have seen these. One of the other items in the top 10 list was a science or fiction earlier this year. I'll remind you that in a minute. So let's go to number two. A large harp-shaped carnivorous sponge that feeds on fish and crustaceans has been discovered in the Pacific. You guys all think that one is science as well. And that one is the fiction. Sorry, guys.
I really like the idea of a carnivorous
sponge. The harp
sponge.
And the sponge.
Yeah, me too.
So there is the species, the Chondrocladia lyra, was discovered. It is a harp-shaped sponge, very pretty, but it feeds on plankton.
Boring.
Doesn't eat fish and crustaceans.
Hmm.
That was the implausible part. Which means, however, that a new species of cockroach that glows in the dark and has been identified but may already be extinct is science. This guy was identified. He was described and officially became a species in the last year, but he is known from a single specimen collected 70 years ago. From an area recently heavily impacted by the eruption of the Kangaroo volcano. So they're concerned that it may have already been wiped out, even as it's being discovered. Glow-in-the-dark land-based insects are quite rare. Most glow-in-the-dark stuff is in the ocean. But everyone knows fireflies, right? So they're the most common one that people know of. Most of them are beetles. Mm-hmm. Most glow-in-the-dark, insects.
Well, there's more beetles than any other insect, I think. So that makes sense.
Than any other living thing, I think. More different kinds of beetles than any other kind of animal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a cave-inhabiting fungus gnats that glow in the dark. Well, there was a previous species of luminescent cockroach in 1999 that was discovered. But now we have a new one to the list, L. luci. Luci.
Not very luci.
And interestingly, they're only found in areas that are far from any light pollution, which kind of makes sense. It must be hard for them to live in areas where there's lots of light pollution. We screw up their mating calls or whatever. But not for fireflies.
All right, well,
fireflies
good job.
Yeah, those are they're cool insects.
Good job, Steve. You got us.
The links show the pictures are all very pretty. And do you guys remember from earlier this year the lacewing fly?
Yeah.
The beautiful green lacewing with dark markings that was identified from a Flickr picture.
Yeah.
Somebody uploaded the picture to Flickr, and then a scientist saw it and said, hey, that's a new species of lacewing fly. So that also made the top 10 list. Let me go over the other ones really quickly. A teeny tiny itty bitty. These are all, I should say.
Yellow polka dot bikini.
It's going there.
A teeny tiny itty bitty violet. Viola lilliputana from Lilliputian. A 1 centimeter tall violet. A new monkey from Africa, only the second one to be discovered in the last 28 years. The Lesula monkey has very human-looking eyes, very cute. A snake called Sibon Noalamina, which means no to the mine. I guess it's a Spanish phrase for people who are protesting mining operations, because its habitat's probably been mostly wiped out by mining operations. So they named it after the social movement. And
that's kind of cool.
A black stain on a cave walls. It's due to a fungus.
Excuse me?
A black fungus that is a problem because it's actually threatening Paleolithic art.
That's bad.
Yeah. Like those caves in France that have the Paleolithic art. There was a white fungus threatening them, and now they wiped out the white fungus and it was replaced with a black fungus. That's good work, boys.
I wonder
what would take precedence. What if the new fungus is endangered?
Yeah.
What would take precedence, the art or the fungus?
The art.
Mm. Oh, the art. Remember the prime directive, though.
And then Eugenia Scott. Eugenia, which is it's a genus of woody evergreen trees. And they discovered a new species, Petrakensis, which has pretty, glossy green leaves and clusters of magenta flowers. Very pretty. The beetle, let's see, the lacewing fly. And number 10 is, this is a fossil species, a species of hanging fly. The hanging fly, as the name implies, hangs from certain species of ginkgo plants, and it's camouflage, so it looks like the leaves. Its wings looks like the leaves of the plant, and it hangs there and then eats other insects that come close. So they identified both a fossil hanging fly and the fossil plant that it was mimicking from about 165 million years ago. Top 10 new species discovered and described in 2012.
I must have missed that from David Letterman's show last year.
You can vote for the 2013 species.
Oh, you can vote? Oh.
Right now. Yeah, you can submit your vote, your choice, and they'll be chosen for next year. So keep an eye out for this science or fiction next year. All right, well, thanks for playing this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
It's good to play. Good job.
Thanks, Steve.
I'm sure if Bob were here, he would have gotten it.
No doubt about it.
Yeah. And we'd be running another 10 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Jay, give us a quote.
Forrest Dramis from Jackson, Wyoming sent in this awesome quote. Do you guys know who Karl Popper is?
Oh, yeah.
He's a philosopher. Born 1902, died 1994, was an Austrian and British philosopher and a professor at the London School of Economics. And he said, whenever a theory appears to you as the only possible one, take this as a sign that you have neither understood the theory nor the problem which it was intended to solve. From Karl Popper getting the chopper.
Couple quick announcements before we close out. There will be one more round of auditions for Ock the Skeptical Caveman. That will be happening on June 13th. So email us at info@theskepticsguide.org if you're interested, or if you're interested in helping out with this video project in any way, or if for some reason you want to give us some money, just email us at info@theskepticsguide.org. And don't forget the amazing meeting 2013 is fast approaching. There will be lots of SGU events at TAM this year. Of course, a live show on the stage, the SGU dinner, SGU poker tournament. Evan and I are each participating in a workshop. And of course, all of the usual amazing meeting awesomeness. So go to amazingmeeting.com. This is July 11th through 14th in Las Vegas. Hope to see a lot of our listeners there. All right. Well, thank you for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Thanks, Doctor. Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.